If you go to Auschwitz, of course, you go to history. You go to a history place, you go to a crime scene, you go to lots of places. But you always go to a place where a mirror is. You see yourself. And you will never be able to be the player of one role. You are not a prisoner. You are not a perpetrator. You are just you, and you have to decide if the question will arise for you, what you do.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organizations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Christoph Hübner. Christoph is a poet and writer of short stories. In addition, he has a long-term collaboration with the Action Reconciliation Service for Peace, which is based in Berlin. He's vice president of the International Auschwitz Committee and a member of the International Auschwitz Council. He's been associated with the International Youth Center at Auschwitz from the beginning and is one of the founders of this institution in Oswiecim. Hello, pleased to meet you.
Hello, nice to meet you. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Christoph. Really good to have you on here today. Thanks very much for joining us. Christoph, you seem to have had a very mixed life, being a writer and a poet, as well as having your connections with Auschwitz and the youth centre there. Could you tell us something about your life and how you ended up on this pathway?
Well, I guess I had quite a normal life. I was educated in a Protestant background family with books, which was very important, that books were quite a normal thing. So read and to enjoy poems and to enjoy words and to see what would happen in a world if we put words together and how many possibilities you have to put words together and where you end up with it. How different, how amazing, how horrible. That was really an experience which was very, very important for me. And most of the poets I know can really remember the moment exactly and talk about it when the first poem came. And they thought, well, this is a poem. It is my poem. Even if nobody else will see it, nobody else will like it, it is a poem and I am a poet. And so since then, I think I'm a poet really. And I know I'm talking too long, but to meet other poets is, it's interesting because you always see that the system of the inner and outer world and the combination between the two of them works similar. A few years ago, we had a meeting in London, in St. James Palace, I think, with Prince Charles. And I discovered that preparing this meeting was Graham Davis, a quite well-known Welsh poet who really is writing wonderful and very interesting poems, which are not specific Welsh, English. They are human in a broad way, about remembrance, about going through the world and discovering things. And I realized seeing him in one of these moments when he had this official program and took out very discreet a pen, and on the back of this official poet program, he started to write the beginning of a poem, I guess. So the words are not really shy. They just use you. You are not the master of the words are the master of you, and you have to accept this.
So can I just ask you, Christoph, what was your first poem that you remember?
The first poem I remember was about pigeons, seeing them sitting, it was a child poem, seeing them sitting on the barn and flying away. And the question I had, was the barn the same without the pigeons, or would be the barn really to normal again when the birds come back? Childish questions, but if you think today, and you think of the sentence, you never will have a swim in the same river, you will never see the same barn. And there will be never be the same barn. There will never be the same day, the same moment even. And to understand this was from a child a long way to go.
So that's really interesting to hear about your how the words captivated you. But I'm wondering also about how then you end up in that role, but also end up involved with Auschwitz and the youth centre there.
Well, words have no guilt. It's the human beings. In Auschwitz, you have words which are beautiful and they mean horrible things. You have this famous night and fog, which was a symbol and a secret code for actions against the Jewish people. You had the remark in the lists of prisoners in Auschwitz of foam of the sea. And it's beautiful. Everybody has associations with it. When we have been to the beach as children, have seen the foam going away, coming and endless. And here it meant the people should disappear forever. Even their names should be cut off of the lists of prisoners. They should disappear as they had never existed before. And so it's our responsibility to give the words their honor back and to try at least say, as I said, were without any responsibility for it.
Thank you. And can you tell us something about the kind of work that you did with Action and Reconciliation?
Well, that was, we were educated by my father, who was has been a soldier in the Second World War. And for him, it was absolutely not acceptable that any of his three sons would join the army, any army. And in these years, you had to do your duty in the German army. It was 18 months, as far as I remember, and we all decided to be conscientious objectors. We didn't go to the army, and the alternative was to go to Action Reconciliation and to work abroad. And that's where I met one of my long, lifelong friends, David, who is sitting opposite here now. And I came to Oxford working in a project of Cyrenians, which, well, the only thing I understood was from the Bible. There was Simon of Cyrene who carried the cross of Christ. And so I had an idea they were doing something social. And they worked with alcoholics mostly, with people being in the war as British soldiers and really being destroyed and never got back into normal life after all what they had seen. Today we have words for that. In these times, David, we didn't even have words. We would have never say, I would have never said traumatisiert. They were just never got back. They never arrived back. And I had to realize that my work there as a young German for them was exciting in one way. They found it exciting that a German boy was coming to washing their dishes and living with them in a more or less primitive shed near the station in Oxford. But of course, I had to realize that these things inside, deep inside them, and very often hidden in them, were war, war, war. And when they were very drunk, they were crying, they were talking about situations they will never forget and who were in them and with them every second of the day. And even there were bizarre situations that one of them, when he was drunk, went to the police and told the police, in our house is a German hiding. He is Martin Bormann. And so the police came. I had to show my passport and prove that I'm not Martin Bormann. And next day he had forgotten about it all. But that was the situation. The name Martin Bormann for them was really a threat on heaven. And it was very, very, very intensive time. I think Dave and me, we both can sign this. And for me, this is the explanation, Naomi, why the relation between David and me is so stable and long ongoing. We very often don't talk for months, but if we start talking after months, we end up right there where we finished the last time half a year ago, and we will never get into conventional standards of talks. We will always be down to the ground.
Yeah, it's very valuable, isn't it, when you've got a relationship that has lasted that amount of time.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true. And it was a time, and I mean, for me, this is important that people in Britain know this as well, that for many Germans who have really developed over the years very deep emotional relations to people in England and Wales, in Scotland, to Great Britain at all this hating, disturbing, dividing business of the last years was really a big, big difficulty and still is a big insult of things we had achieved together. And I don't think any one of us would have expected that these kind of things would happen again. But on the other hand, we know that the things connecting us are much more worthy than all this tactical and hidden tricks and intrigues of the people who organized all this.
I was just thinking, it's very moving what you've just described. I was particularly struck by your phrase, "They never arrived back," which is extraordinarily powerful sentence. But I'm thinking also, you went to other places as well in your work with Action Reconciliation, didn't you? You went to different countries.
Yeah. There was this world of Action Reconciliation to offer contacts, to apologize to all those who have suffered under the German efficiency and anti-Semitism and murder troops. And so I've been to Israel. The Jewish world is very, very important and very very moving for me. I've been to Russia and to Belarus, and well, these people on the eastern side of my world, they arrived somewhere where they never wanted to leave the train, in a system they were not happy with. Only very few were communists or were really taken by the hope that this is a system of the future. Some of them believed that, but well, it took not many years before they'd given up and were very unhappy about unfreedom and injustice in the world they were living in. And mostly of them were poor. And to realize that those of the example, the Russian soldiers of the Red Army who survived Auschwitz, where lots of Soviet prisoners of war were kept and treated horribly. Only very few survived, and they went back. And where were they brought to? To the Gulag, because it was Stalin's idea that everybody who survived must have been a traitor. And so they disappeared the second time in the Gulag, and they only were, in a way, acknowledged as victims of the war in the 80s, late 80s, beginning of the 90s, and then their life mostly was over. They were poor on health, they weren't rich, poor people, and all the life they have had was, well, more or less life of oppression. But they were, in a way, welcoming. They were, in a way, spiritual about books, about knowledge of her literature. Dostoevsky, Chekhov, Tolstoy, Chukchin, many, many others. They knew them all, Isaac Babel. And that was their world. Akhmatova, the poet. And they were living in this world of the spirit and not being influenced very much by the real living conditions around them. They were not important for them.
Yeah.
And not just to add, David, not to make it too idealistic. Of course, I was a left winger. I still am. And in a way, when going there, I don't know what you remember about yourself. I was a bit naive and a believer myself. When our friend Vasil Bukow, a very famous and very, very good writer, several times suggested for the Literature Nobel Prize, when he described the world of the KGB around surrounding him and what they did do and what they could do with him. We always were thinking, well, he's a bit neurotic about this things. He's a world famous man. But he was even a bit shy with us not to describe what they really did to people and what you see these days in Belarus, what is coming out on the end of the process. Vasil Bukow, 1984, has said Lukashenko will be a catastrophe.
You're describing really a time after the war where people went back and found that they were still captured in some way. And that was obviously a process of self-discovery for you as well.
Well, yes. For our generation, it was very important to come to terms with this history who did influence us so much, not only by birth, but by the teachers who educated us, by the people who were around us, even as youngsters, as other people. We had to find a way. And you asked me, Naomi, about Auschwitz. That's one of these things. If you go to Auschwitz, of course, you go to history. You go to a history place, you go to a crime scene, you go to lots of places. But you always go to a place where a mirror is. You see yourself. And you will never be able to be the player of one role. You are not a prisoner. You are not a perpetrator. You are just you, and you have to decide if the question will arise for you, what you do. And it was very interesting with, or it is very interesting with people, if they come and first they easy going a little bit, and then they suddenly realize it's about me. It's not about them. This is about me. And it was very important, David, with Kazuo Ishiguro, when we joined him to go to Auschwitz. And he told us before that he hardly never accepted any invitations because it took him too long time and he didn't want to interrupt writing processes. But this, he decided for himself, is a challenge. I have to go there. And he understood it perfectly. Within a minute, it's about me. It's about my parents, the Japanese thing, the living in Britain, the rising, the growing up in Britain, the role Auschwitz as a symbol has in the world today. And a symbol. So a few days ago, you read in The Guardian that in Arizona, they have bought chemicals to mix up Cyclone B and to kill people in the dead cells with gas. You feel crazy. What? People are killing other people again with Cyclone B? Are they the next time you read about the synagogue in a southern German town attacked? You read something in Britain about anti-Semitic rumors in the Labour Party or something. And very often I am asked, so how long the Auschwitz Committee will work on? And it's a stupid question, but nevertheless a true one. You are deciding it.
You said something very powerful there about the mirror and about looking in the mirror. And I wondered how German culture is influenced by being brave enough to actually accept that mirror is there and looking in the mirror. Whereas I think for us in Britain, certainly there's an avoidance of addressing things like colonialism and the empire history. So there's a kind of an avoidance of seeing that there's a mirror there.
Well, there's a nice Chinese poem. I think it's Po Yu from the 9th century or something. Wherever the tree is, the wind will get to it. And so, however you discuss the empire now and how proud people are on the empire and the peace working forces of the empire and things, the time will come that people will talk about family stories, about family memories, about what the empire meant and what it mentally means for many people until today. Whether there really is a chance for the empire to have a kind of group of people united on the same level with justice and freedom. Let's see. You had the same situation in France when they were discussing all the time about the resistance in the Second World War. There wasn't any word about Vichy and about Pétain. They didn't do these kind of things, but now they are right in the middle of this. And I think it was Chirac who apologized for the Jewish French population for these kinds of things. And again, in France, you have a massive anti-Semitic attitudes within the population. And this in Germany is a problem as well. So you have to discuss the past because it is already back.
Yeah. Well, in the work that you did with Auschwitz, Christoph, I believe that you also worked with some former prisoners of the camp. And how did that go? How did they cope with the traumatic experiences they lived through?
I have met about three survivors who were aggressive towards the world of today, because thinking of what happened to them, how could the world have let this happen? What is the world doing today? They were bitter, a bit aggressive, and difficult to bear. But most of them are shy. They don't want to be on people's nerves. They realize they have to tell what happened to them. And they feel obliged to their families because they are mostly the only one who survived. There was no family. And Dorota Tugendreich from Łódź, a Jewish girl, was quite sure that she had to talk about her parents. They were not longer with her, but she didn't want them to be forgotten. And you see, I don't have a microphone and I don't have a kind of tape recorder or what you call this today. I sit on a dinner table with a small, tender lady from Budapest, and she has very short cut hair. And joking tone, she says to me, "Well, Christoph, don't think I always had my hair cut this way. As a child, I had beautiful, long, blonde hair." And I said, "Oh, that's nice to hear." "Yeah," she said. And then I was really totally disturbed and in a bad situation when my father decided to cut off my hair. And I screamed and I shouted at him and I felt really totally under his pressure. And and all the story ended that this was in the times of fascism in Hungary, before the Germans marched in. The Hungarian fascists were already in the streets and doing their jobs by killing Jewish people. And she told me that they were all lined up on the banks of the River Danube. And then three kids were packed together and were linked together with a strick, seil, something, you bind something together. And they set these three children near to the river and they shot the middle one in the head, and this one took the two others who were bind to her within falling to the River Danube. And then Eva told me that because her hair was cut short, she was able to not being drowned, but to get rid of this Strick and to swim down the river, to swim with the river, and 2 kilometers down, she was able to escape.
Gosh.
And these are the stories. And she doesn't want to tell me the story to be something special. It's a sign of trust. And
but there's also an awful burden there, isn't there? And you can see why people who've survived those circumstances feel an obligation to talk about it so everyone is aware of the horror of it, but equally it must keep them kind of like tied in and connected to their traumatic past. It's hard to shake that off and move on, isn't it, if you have to keep retelling such awful stories.
They have to build up trust to talk about it, but most of them have really lived a very courageous life. They have married, which is, most of them have married survivors too, not to talk Naomi all the time about Auschwitz, but not to talk about Auschwitz, just to know how he is determined. He is the same, on the same level like I am, and he knows what I am through, and I know what she is through. And this is many of their children to accuse them. They never said a word to the children because they wanted them not to be linked to Auschwitz. They wanted them to have a normal life. But of course, then the children insulted them and said, why did you never talk? It's a complex story, and it's very important for me to make it very, very clear. The time we have laughed together and enjoyed each other is much more than the time we've cried together. And of course, they are difficult to take because they have special habits. For Michelle, my wife, it's very hard to accept that they never accept privacy while eating. So if Michelle has got a cake, a nice strawberry cake, suddenly from somewhere from the table, the fork will come and say, what have you got there? And within 2 seconds, her piece of cake has disappeared. And they have tried and shared. That's what they did in Auschwitz, of course. And never leave anything on the table. You never know when you will have the next time something on the table. So these are kinds of things which are very deeply built in their memory and in their soul. Am I talking too much?
No, not at all. It's very powerful and very heavy.
And ineffable. I was just looking up the word then because I wasn't sure whether it was the right word to use, but what you're saying in your words is too big to put into words, even though you're doing extremely well in doing so. But I was thinking, some 40 years ago, you, together with Alvin Meyer and Jürgen Pipelov, do I pronounce Jürgen's name correctly?
Yeah, more or less, yes.
More or less, thank you. That's been the story of my life, more or less.
Probably at the end, you say Pipelov.
Pipelov.
That's the Russian version.
So you produced this book, the one here, which is called Signs of Life Seen in Auschwitz, a book of poignant pictures and drawings. And this could suggest that even in such dreadful circumstances, people were capable of great creativity. Do you see it like that? Is that how you see it?
Yeah, exactly what you are saying. And This is important for me. You know, I work a lot with young people from Volkswagen in Auschwitz, and it's very important. They have a certain understanding of resistance. What is resistance? You have to have a gun, you fight. And I have to explain them, resistance is, you remember, a poem. And I have talked about Dorota before. And that was one of these stories, that when they were taken to the toilet, to this big toilet, one toilet on the other, to go together and to sit there and to smell all of you and to see the others in this horrible situation. Very often you had the feeling the best thing is you get back and fall behind. You are really at the end and just shit. And that was what they were told all the day. You are a piece of shit. And in this moment, she evoked poems from the school. And she told them to the girl sitting next to her. And they will give it to the next one. And that was resistance. No, we are not a piece of shit. We are a human being. We have been educated. We are able to remember and to create words and poems ourselves. We will get out of here and we will be back in life. And people in Auschwitz have done many of these small things. Of course, you can say, well, ooh. But that people who have written down what they've seen, all this was under the threat of their life. Nobody was allowed to see this, otherwise they would have been shot right away. And so they were really risking their lives all the time. At the moment they were creative, at the moment they were encouraging other people, and at the moment they were together in a way of communication, not to fall in silence. That was the one side. And the other side, Lebenszeichen, signs of life, not to be too idealistic again, is, and it's interesting, David, that the survivors start to talk about this only in the last years, about these other things, that somebody slept with his shoes under his head. Nobody could steal him. And of course they were stolen. He was so falling in a deep sleep, hungry, tired, that they were pinched. And to have shoes was a very, very important condition for survival. If you didn't have shoes, it was very, very difficult. After a few days, your feet were swollen, bleeding, and you couldn't walk, you couldn't work, and you were a case for the gas chamber. So Alex Deutsch from Berlin, he was a baker. He had learned to be a baker, a Jew from Berlin, and he told me the only medicine he had for his rotten feet was every evening to piss on them. And to hope that this was a kind of disinfection and of a healing effect for his feet. Yeah, people did do horrible things to other people to survive. This is one of the reality of Auschwitz too.
Thank you. In our podcast, we've been interested to think about what it is that enables people to survive under extremely demanding and testing conditions. Of course, it's elusive. We can't really be sure. But I want to challenge you a little bit on what you're saying, because if you remember inside this book, that picture appears again, and beside it is a small poem, Der hat uns geschlagen in seinem Stock, den hab ich geschlagen mit meiner Tusch, which I translated in my more or less competent manner. He has us beaten with his stick. I have it beaten with my ink. Are you still as optimistic as you were 40 years ago?
Well, I wouldn't know. I am regarding the times at the moment, whether to be optimistic. But we keep going. And even if you are more realistic, which would necessarily mean pessimistic, there are reasons for pessimism. And you could say, well, we have worked 30, 40 years now and nothing has really changed. They are coming back. They are creeping out of their holes again. They are mixing with the thoughts of the fanatic Islamists and the old anti-Semites. And it's all in a rotten world of hate and of lies and of capitalist thinking. It's despair. But on the other hand, you know, people who just do things, like you do your podcast. Why do you do it? Because you didn't have anything else to do, because you had an idea to add something into a world which obviously often forgets, which needs input, intellectual, emotional input, and encouragement. And that's the only thing we can do. And I was very, very moved. I've seen a few weeks ago an interview with Kazuo Ishiguro about his new book, Clara and the Sun. And he said that looking back and describing the world now, his impression is the world is harsher, and but the people are not more bad than they had been. They might be even better. Young people coming here understand that the past is their beginning, and that it's up to them what they are going to add to the story as a new chapter. For me, it's very often interesting, and maybe this happens to you as well, how often we are asked, what will happen if there's no survivor alive? People get very nervous about this question. Why? And I think the answer is because we are not sure whether we will do it, whether we will accept a situation when we are responsible on our own. And so it's good that this house here in Oswiecim is existing, and that people learn to accept their emotional responsibility, not as a political lecture, but as a lecture of their family, of their mental tradition as Germans, as their mental traditions of Turkish Germans or Arab Germans, or of members of a family where some people have been with the SS. All this happens here, that people, yeah, realize suddenly the history and they want to know more. They want to know where they come from and where they want to go.
You are obviously still involved because you're there at the moment. Tell us about the seminars that you hold and the people you bring from Volkswagen.
Well, this was my colleague Ines Doberanske. Young people from Volkswagen, from Poland and from Germany. And the most important thing is that they work in the museum. They help maintaining the place. They clean the place, they dig the streets, which are overburdened with grass now and with soil. So the work for them is very, very important. Of course, they work mostly in places where visitors do see them. And they come and ask, what are you doing here? And they have to explain themselves. Not, I've been sent here and I didn't know why, but now I'm doing my job. That was the answer the SS was giving. I didn't know where I was, but I did my job. And it was all orders. They have to think about themselves. And I do guided tours with them in the afternoons. Not every afternoon. We have a changement. In the mornings, they do work for 4.5 hours. And in the afternoon, one afternoon, we go for guided tours to the museum. And one afternoon, the next one, we do something different. We go shopping to a shopping mall. We go to the mountains. We just don't do anything, intellectual. But of course, I do tell about the landscape, the history of the landscape, about history or so. So they enjoy it. And I enjoy it, David. If I go with my colleague Ines to Wolfsburg, there are many generations by now who just, hello, we will never forget it, what you told us there. And it's a good place.
And how many times a year do these groups come, or presumably not?
5 groups a year. They stay for 2 weeks each. So they have really time, the luxury of time. And there are managers, young managers coming now as well for 4 days. Well, Volkswagen is the only firm who does this because of their own firm history. They have been very linked, very close to the Nazis and to Hitler. They had slave laborers in the newly existing firm. And so for them, it's a kind of dealing with their history as well.
Seems right that burden of responsibility for remembering is held by them, doesn't it? I mean, it seems inevitable that the survivors are carrying that, but so much could be done by those with some history of culpability within it.
Yeah, they have. There are two things. They have meetings here, the young people with survivors, and well, the survivors, for them, it's really, they say, well, I never had expected to see in my life a German-Polish group on this place, and they work together in the museum. But, of course, it's not only a talking about Auschwitz. There are other items, like human rights in China. For Volkswagen, this is a very important item. They are under much criticism about the Uyghurs. And how can you have standards, if you work as a global player, how can you have standards of human rights within your factories? How far are you responsible for that? What happens around the factory in the country you are in? And this will be one of the main questions for the global world. You have many firms who are working internationally and who are part of the system in China or in Myanmar or wherever. And they have to deal with it and to react on it.
Christoph, if one visits these places, for example, Auschwitz, but I've been to Stushoff, of course, as well. You can't help but be struck by the enormous weight of the terrible events that took place there. And I was wondering, how do you personally deal with these things?
Well, there are periods in life when you deal with these things as a burden difficultly. And at the moment, there is such a period where I do think, can I keep going? And how long should I do this? And but on the other hand, there is burden means as well a duty to do things. And there's this beautiful poem of an American poet. I don't remember the start, but it ends, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. And there are miles to go before I sleep. And David, and if you feel really in a bad situation, then suddenly there are people who give you an input of encouragement, which is not meant to be one, but it's just a nice remark and a sign of there's a fellow person who is in the same situation and who is thinking of you with sympathy and with encouragement. And that is very, very important these days.
I think there's a line in Turandot, the opera, where the servant girl is asked by the prince, well, why do you do these things for us? And she replied, because once you smiled at me. And it's a very strong line.
Well, definitely, yeah. This is a very strong line, yeah.
You can really hear, even in just sharing those tiny small stories that you've shared with us today, you can hear the kind of like the pain of that. There's, you know, you commented at one point on our silence, but it was really about the emotional heaviness of the subject. And so you know, thinking about that burden on you, and I hear you say that sometimes it feels too weighty and then you have this encouragement, but I wonder, you know, what are the ways that you've coped with a very long time steeped in a very, very painful episode of not just history, but the living onwards of that? And how do you cope with that?
Well, I think that's a result of education or of genes, let's say. My father was a very serious person, and was heavy, put heavy into the world. And my mother was the right opposite. She was a very humorous and very stable person. And she gave me this humor to make situations a bit less sharp than they used to be. If I realize that we sit on an evening table with survivors and it will get too, then I will say, I want to tell you something which is more easy, life-ish, a remembrance which they can share and which is good for them to laugh. And so to be, to find the easy way of life, as life as a possibility of life. This is very important. And I was smiling yesterday. That's this typical thing I got from my mother, this kind of stupid jokes. When I was leaving the office, a few meters from here, I've seen that one of the colleagues with a phone went out into the garden and phoned there because it was very hot in the office. So very secretly, I went to the door and I locked the door behind her. Well, after 2 minutes, she stopped phoning and she was knocking on the door. And I, by then, had disappeared away. And so they were asking Jerome, one of the colleagues, did you lock the door? Why did you do that? And then somebody from upstairs shouted, no, you haven't seen Mr. Heubner being here. That's typical for him. And that's typical to make situations easier and laughing for people. And that's very important with the young people, to laugh a lot, to laugh, to laugh, to laugh. And yeah, we have laughed a lot together, David, much more than crying anyway. And he has been to Auschwitz and has given lectures here. And yeah, and things are so funny. But when we have been together here, that somebody who was with us then, and I had this totally forgotten, told me years later, do you remember when we rushed into that hotel on our way to the bus and nearly rushed down the waiter because we so urgently needed to go to the toilet because we had drank too much beer? I had it forgotten totally, but he remembered it. And obviously this person you have chosen as your partner for this, you should be careful with. He drank much of beer this evening and we nearly rushed down the waiter in a hotel on our way back to the bus. So, but what was it, David? It was one day we wanted to go away from Auschwitz. That was the background. It was in Krakow. And we all felt this evening we don't want to spend here. We want to go to a living world and not to the world where the dead people are living with us.
Yeah, you're talking about whilst it's so important to remember the kind of like dark side of human nature, how also it's just as important to have the light there. And I guess that's partly why David and I started the podcast, was being very aware of working in prisons brings you in touch with the kind of like the darker side of life, which can take its toll on people that are in prison, staff that work in prison also, and wanting to contribute something that can share something of the light as well at the same time. So really, it's such a powerful conversation today, Christoph. Been so interesting to hear your insights.
Well, thank you very much. And that I absolutely agree what you said last. That's we are very close to each other with this thinking and with this background. Take care of yourself and stay well. Looking forward to hear it sometimes.
Thank you very much, Christoph. Great to see you again. Great to see Jerome. Now go off and catch your plane.
Gosh, that was such a powerful conversation with Christoph. I enjoyed it, but it touched on such weighty, heavy themes that at times I was quite lost for words during that conversation.
Yeah, it was very powerful, and it took me right back, because Christoph and I have a long history together, and he was talking about early days when we worked in Oxford at the shelter, and he was talking about the men there, and he said absolutely accurately that we didn't have the words to describe it at that time, and the way that he put it now was they never arrived back. So many of these men who were living in this shelter drinking meths and surgical spirit or cheap wine had served in the war and had never somehow recovered from that. And I found that very affecting. The other phrase that he used was night and fog, and I looked that up after we'd finished talking to him. And in fact, there's a film called Night and Fog, which Alain René, the French director, made in 1955, which is, well, it's only half an hour documentary. It's very painful to watch, actually, but worthwhile if you can find it on YouTube. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.